Welcome, everybody, and thank you very much for coming this afternoon. My name is Taylor Siebold. I'm a senior program officer in the grant program here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and it's my pleasure to be the moderator of this afternoon's discussion. We have with us, and I will just introduce them very briefly because their bios are out on the table. You can read about all the illustrious achievements at your leisure. We have with us Teresa Whitfield, who is at the Social Science Research Council, and she directs the Conflict Prevention and Peace Forum at the SSRC. Most importantly for today's event, she is the author of the book, Friends Indeed. We're very pleased to have two fabulous commentators. Chester Crocker is a Schlesinger Professor of Strategic Studies at Georgetown University. And we always like to think of him as a member of our board of directors here at the Institute. He was chairman of the board here for 12 years from 1992 to 2004. Karen von Hippel is at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where she's the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project, and she's also a senior fellow there with the International Security Program. Let me say a few words about the book and how it came about, and then I will hand over to Teresa to elaborate for about half an hour, and the discussants will also limit their comments so that we then have time afterward for discussion and questions from you. Several years ago, the Institute gave a grant to Teresa to support her work on this book about what is an increasingly common but still little understood phenomenon of conflict mediation, multilateral mediation, I should say, that goes by the strange name of friends, friends of the Secretary General or friends of a particular conflict. These friends groups are states that come together voluntarily to support UN peacemaking and peace operation efforts. This mechanism of diplomacy is just a small part of an increasingly active UN system. It is, we think, however, an important element in understanding global security governance today, and we're very pleased that Teresa has done this work to illuminate how these friend systems work and how to make them work better. She set out to achieve two main goals. First of all, to understand what has gone before, and secondly, to make recommendations to policymakers to improve this process. And I'm pleased to say that the book, Friends Indeed, succeeds fully in achieving both of those goals. Whitfield provides an overview of the types of groups and coalitions that have become actively engaged in issues of peace and security within the UN sphere. And it's important to provide an overview of the types because these groups of friends are not all the same, and their composition and the topics that they address has a big impact on whether or not they're successful. She goes on to identify five core factors that influence success, and I'm not going to spill the beans on what those are, but I'm sure that Teresa will tell us. She also talks about six cases, and they are in the table of contents: El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, Georgia, Western Sahara, and East Timor. And she concludes by drawing all of this together into recommendations of what works best, not only what works best, but when, where, and why it works best. Before I hand over the microphone, I'd like to ask you all to turn off your cell phones so that we're not disturbed in the course of this conversation. And with that, I will turn it over to Teresa. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Taylor, and thank you all for coming, and particularly thanks to my commentators. I'm particularly honored to have had Chet Crocker write the introduction to the book and to show up today. When I was at the UN, my first boss was an Undersecretary General called Marek Goulding, who lots of people were quite nervous of and I got on very well with. And I was very impressed but not surprised when May Goulding wrote his book and revealed how scared he had been of Chet Crocker when Chet was Assistant Secretary General, and so it made me feel a little bit better about nerves in his presence, which I will try and avoid as I talk about my book. I'd also like to thank the USIP in a number of different ways. First of all, and most substantively, for the influence and the background reading and the work that USIP has done on mediation, on multi-party mediation, on intractability in conflict, and exploration a lot of it in the edited volumes that you will be familiar with Chet as one of the editors. That provided a really essential background and context to a lot of the work that I've been trying to do. On top of that, they gave me money, which is nice and essential under such circumstances, and also excellent support through production. An editor I've never met is now no longer with USIP, Nigel Quinney, quite literally rescued me from throwing 400 pages in the bin at one point, and so I remain particularly grateful to him, but Kurt Volkan and others who helped see it through production also did a great job. And finally, for today, thank you very much for organising today. I'm going to talk a little bit about the origins of the book and how it's organised, and something about what I found difficult about writing it. One of the things that Nigel helped me to do when pulling me out of misery was that it was okay to explain why I was having such a difficult time analysing the vast amounts of research I'd gathered, and that having such a difficult time on the analysis was perhaps part of the point rather than just a nightmare to be encountered in sleepless moments at 3 a.m. And then I'll move on to talk a little bit about the conclusions and recommendations. As the book makes clear, I was an official in the UN Secretariat for 5 years, but I came to it from a rather peculiar direction, and the peculiar direction also encouraged me to then leave it again and to write this book. I've had a completely messy career trajectory, and still don't really know what I want to do when I grow up, which is a bit of a problem. In fact, it's rather a crisis moment of having finished the book. I was a journalist and before I joined the UN, and I worked mainly on sort of documentary news reports, television, and I produced a documentary about the murder of 6 Jesuit priests in El Salvador. Got very tangled up in that story and stayed in El Salvador to write a book that was addressing what the murder of these Jesuits might mean, what it meant for US policy, and what it meant particularly for the UN mediation of the end of the civil war in El Salvador. That was my first encounter with the UN, and I encountered the UN originally from the outside as a journalist, and then in 1995, I was asked to join the UN Secretariat in the Political Affairs Department to work on El Salvador as the UN closed down a peacekeeping operation and it moved to the Political Department. I arrived in the UN and I knew everything possible about El Salvador at that moment and all the intricacies of the divisions within the FMLN and all of that. Absolutely nothing about the UN. I don't think I knew the difference between the General Assembly and the Security Council, but I did learn one thing, which is that the UN is very, very important to develop a good sheen and cover over what you don't learn, and meanwhile quickly catch up from behind, and that remains a very useful skill working in this world, and I encourage those of you, and a lot of you are very young here, to quickly grasp it. I was in the UN from 95 to 2000, which was a very particular period. It was that 95 was a kind of low point for the UN in many respects. Some of the sheen of the UN at the end of the Cold War period had been badly tarnished by the mess of the Balkans, the tragedy of Rwanda. Srebrenica happened a few months after I got there. The next thing, I of course was just sitting for the first 8-10 months on my Salvador desk keeping my nose clean while just head down on El Salvador, and then I worked on the negotiations in Guatemala and moved up to work as a special assistant to senior officials working on a whole lot of different issues. And then the next thing that happened was the battle to oust Boutros Ghali, which was fairly depressing to watch from the inside. The arrival of Kofi Annan improved morale, and there was an initial reform effort, and things were difficult, but there was a sense that things were going to turn around.
another crisis inside the UN over the identity and purposes of the UN occurred over Kosovo, rescued to some extent by when the operation in Kosovo came back to the UN after the intervention had been conducted outside it, and then East Timor made the UN in one sense feel better. The Security Council started feeling that it had a purpose in the world because it had reacted quite quickly to authorize intervention in East Timor, and it appeared that it could turn East Timor around. And then as I was leaving in 2000, a recognition that the internal structures of the UN were not really up to the sudden mushrooming in peacekeeping operations, and particularly in Africa, led to the Brahimi report and a big effort to increase the capacity in peacekeeping particularly. I went back to the UN briefly in 2003 after the Iraq bombings killed a number of friends and colleagues, Sergio Vera de Mello, who I had worked with, but then also my closest friend at the UN who was killed in that bombing, who's somebody called Rick Hooper. I went back to, he was working as in the office of the Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, so I went back then and had a very different vantage point on the UN and on the Secretariat in a particularly traumatized moment. I say this because the kind of history of it and the interest in this rather obscure topic, or it seemed quite obscure when I started writing the book, comes from having watched things from an inside perspective in El Salvador. It was the first instance in which a mechanism of friends was used, an informal group of states, Spain, Mexico, Venezuela and Colombia worked in support of the Secretary General's representative and in close contact with the conflict parties, the FMLN guerrillas and the government of El Salvador, and played a generally very helpful role in the negotiations. I knew about them because I knew about El Salvador, and then I got to the UN, and you found oneself surrounded by a variety of other mechanisms like that. There were friends of the Guatemalan peace process, there were friends in Haiti, which Secretariat officials grumbled about much more because they were always being bossed about by the US on Haiti in that period. Friends of Georgia, friends of Tajikistan at some point, friends all over. And as I watched the UN up to 2000, there was a real mushrooming of groups, friends groups, core groups, the contact group obviously on the Balkans, other contact groups, troikas, quartets, the quint, a very perplexing environment. At the same time, there was very little documentation on these mechanisms. I should, of course, recognize that one of the earliest, if not the earliest, of such informal but heavy state-run mechanisms was the contact group in Namibia, which I'm sure Chet will mention and talk about, which predates all of them. The other aspect of these mechanisms was that there was very little attention being paid to them for a couple of reasons. They were largely informal. There were no records kept. There was no written account of their meetings. There were very little reference to them, even in the formal documents of the United Nations and within the Secretariat at that time. And it's something that's changed quite a lot since then. But in the Secretariat of the mid 1990s, there was a quite extraordinary lack of attention to documentation and the learning of lessons. Lessons were learned in a very, very haphazard way, almost exclusively by the trajectory of individual officials, so people with experience. And you could, depending on the chronology of the missions, you could see that people with experience of Cambodia, a lot of them moved to the Balkans. Some of the lessons that were learned in Cambodia were useful for the Balkans, quite a lot of them were not. More sensibly, at a later point, people who were working on El Salvador, some of them worked in Guatemala, at least it was in the same region, and the intervention in Guatemala did learn quite a lot of lessons. But there was no systematic review. There weren't even kind of exit analyses by senior officials or necessarily write-ups of case studies of things that they'd mediated or been involved in. Points to the value of the work of USIP, particularly in herding cats, which drew together the first-person account by numbers of mediators, some of them UN mediators, and there's a chapter on El Salvador there, in many cases, it was the first time that these people were actually being asked to assess and think about what they did. obviously, as first-person accounts, they suffered a little bit from a kind of rosy-tinted hue in some cases, including the one that I worked on to help with. But it was nevertheless very important. This led me, when I left the UN in 2000, mainly for personal reasons and remained, I got two small children and they were a lot smaller then, and I was offered nice consulting jobs that were a bit more flexible. But after a while, I began to think more that there was a real gap, and that it wasn't just a sort of gap in terms of that this is a good subject to do research on, but that it might actually be useful. And to expand the kind of cross-fertilization of lessons, so it wasn't just the teams of people who'd worked on Latin America who knew about one set of things, but that some of those lessons would go across. The biggest example of kind of lack of lessons was at one point in the early 2000s, there was a paper prepared for a discussion that the Secretary General was having with key African states and key Western states working on setting up new structures in Africa at the time the African Union was created, and discussion of NEPAD encouraging. The idea was to encourage the formation of groups of one kind or other. And there was a paper prepared from within the Department of Political Affairs on groups and what they'd done and what they hadn't done, and it made no reference to any group outside Africa at all, as if they hadn't, mainly because the officials working on Africa hadn't kind of crossed the corridor to ask the others what they might know. So one of the gratifying, so for this reason, when I set out to write this book, I was determined to try and do it in a way that would be useful and would have some policy and practical recommendations, which is always quite a hard thing to do because policymakers are very busy and the last thing they want to do is listen. And I think one of the most gratifying aspects of the research I did for the book was the fact that I was very frequently called on by people who I interviewed. I interviewed lots and lots of people for this book, and about 200, some of them who I went back to very often, and they were secretariat officials, representatives of member states, representatives, very importantly, of conflict parties who were kind of at the receiving end of the friends and their efforts, as well as others. But people would call me and say, what do you think about this? There's an initiative to have a Friends of Guinea, or can you call Lloyd Axworthy's assistant and say why Friends of Ethiopia and Eritrea won't work? I mean, it was very directly drawn into sort of real-time political processes, which was fun. Of course, the upshot of all this is I write a sort of 300-page book with 100 ghastly pages of notes, and there it is. And then I finally, at the end of the whole thing, I get a call from the UN saying, could you do a summary of your book in a 2-page note of guidance? which I did, which I suppose that's useful. So that's where the book comes from, and it reflects, I think, a kind of one foot in, one foot out. It wouldn't have been possible without very, very good access to people who are directly engaged in mediation and mediation support, just because the documents are not there. How the book is structured is reflected some of the struggles of that I faced in amassing masses of information and trying to find a useful way to organise it. There's a first chapter which looks at peacemaking and the emergence of groups in the context of the change in conflict management in the post-Cold War world, which will be very familiar to all of you, the massive explosion of peacemakers, shifts in the nature of conflict, or if not, and there's a big debate about the extent to which wars following the end of the Cold War period are new wars or not. One of the things they certainly were was new to the United Nations. The United Nations had not involved itself in messy internal conflicts of the kind in which it was suddenly thrown into the mid-1990s. So for the UN, it was new, even if there is a vibrant academic debate about the extent to which the conflicts or criminalized conflicts were new or not. The chapter also struggles or tries to place the role of the Office of Secretary General in the midst of this complicated framework. Secretary General, I mean, it's one of the things that I find most fascinating about working inside the
the Secretariat, you normally work for the Secretary General. When you join the UN, you have to sign a lot of quite alarming but quite impressive forms about how you won't accept instructions from your government, and you know, your status and role as an international civil servant and the responsibilities that brings with it. They're quite impressive until you get to the point where it says that you will not discuss any aspect of your work with anybody, which sort of almost limits you to silence. So you sign away and then you realise that some of it is a bit more flexible than other of it. But what it does bring home, the process of being inside the Secretariat and working for the Secretary General, is the question of what it means to be an international civil servant, what the Secretary General stands for, which is, of course, a notoriously impossible position with an notoriously impossible job. He's the CAO of a completely dysfunctional multilateral organisation, which I'm afraid I believe is sort of in badly need of reform, but also beyond reform as well. I don't think it'll ever be very, very streamlined. The political instrument of the Security Council, and Secretary General must implement the mandates of the Security Council. But also the Secretary General embodies a kind of amorphous moral authority. He's there in many respects to represent more than the narrow national interests of any particular state, and yet he can do nothing without those states behind them, and as a result of that rather contradictory position, he's constantly, I say he because there hasn't been a she yet, but constantly buffeted by the interests of member states, which push, pull, and nag in all sorts of directions at once. One of the things that I found most appealing and intriguing about the work on Friends is, in many ways, they represent that dilemma in a very stark way. They are groups which are overtly committed to the greater good. They're overtly committed to promoting peace, and that must be a good thing. And yet, they're also very much representations of the individual interests of the state. So that tension remains, is one that goes right through the book. After the introductory chapter, I have six core case studies: El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, Georgia, which is the Abkhaz conflict in Georgia, Western Sahara, and East Timor. These are all cases which have had Friends mechanisms that have, to some extent, considered themselves friends of the Secretary General. They had very, very different trajectories in very different contexts, and are briefly, I'm sure many of you are familiar with some of the conflicts, though perhaps not all. El Salvador and Guatemala are both insurgent conflicts, ideological conflicts that arose in the context of the Cold War, but also based on histories of injustice and repression in their own countries. They both led to negotiated settlements and complicated processes of implementation. Both countries have and in that respect, the peace processes were successful. But both countries, and Guatemala in particular, as we've seen from the violence that's run up to the elections, have suffered very much from criminalized cultures and forces and levels of violence in the post-Cold War period, which have imperiled further progress, particularly in Guatemala. Haiti, there was a succession of mechanisms accompanying a very, very complicated process, which has been sort of really a very long-running saga for the international community, and in my view, one of the saddest of sagas, given the scale of Haiti and the level of international attention and the state that Haiti is in today. I was there in June, and though it's a moment of some hope that things may get better, that it's really depressing if you look backwards and think of 15 years of international attempts to make things better. It saw, from the election of Aristide in 1990, saw elections, a coup, sanctions, intervention, a succession of efforts at peace building before the peace builders gave up in 2000 and left, back to internal unrest. Aristide's second departure,
and a new round of UN peacekeeping from 2004 with a number of different group mechanisms. It was a tight group of friends of the Secretary General to begin with the key actors on Haiti, which remain preeminent among them, the United States, of course, but also Canada, France, and in those days Venezuela was very engaged. And today it remains Canada, France, the US, and Latin Americans are now in a very different relationship to Haiti as they're actually leading the peacekeeping effort. Georgia was a group. I should say that one of the things that I look at quite carefully in throughout the book is the inception of friends groups. Whose idea was it to form a group of friends, and what was the purposes, and to what end was it possible to control both the composition and the purposes and the relationship, the relationships that those determined. In Georgia, there was a group of friends that was, from the Secretariat's perspective, doomed from the start by being called the Friends of Georgia, and that when the conflict was a secessionist one between the tiny entity of Abkhazia that succeeded or tried to succeed in a war that was a reflection of the messy borders of the Soviet Union and them coming apart, and the Abkhaz won in military terms, but only because they were counted with support from Russia. And so there was a sense within the Secretariat that how could you have a friends group if it was ostensibly friends of one party to a conflict? And it was something that the Abkhaz, quite understandably, I have to say, consistently complained about to the UN. It was coloured in the early days by the fact that the president of Georgia was Shevardnadze, who of course was seen by many and understandably as one of the heroes of the end of the Soviet Union, and so counted on an enormous amount of support from the West, even as his own capacity to run Georgia became undermined by various problems of institutional strength and corruption and things. At a later point, in 1995, the Friends were reconstituted of Friends of the Secretary General for Georgia. It was one of those sort of diplomatic niceties that made a bit of difference on the ground, though the group itself remained and remains very divided between states, Western states, the US, UK, France and Germany, that clearly align with the position of the government of Georgia, and Russia, which has a very, very complicated, is aligned with Abkhazia, but in the context of very complicated relations with Georgia itself, and obviously relating at this point to other interests, including oil and struggles for influence and power in the region that extend far beyond the tiny little contested territory of Abkhazia. Western Sahara is probably this is a case that I know Chet knows well, having worked on it a long time, represents the case of a really disastrous friends group in terms of actually trying to achieve the stated goal, which was UN has, since the early 90s, been embarked on trying to oversee the process of self-determination of the Sahrawi people through a settlement plan that would provide for a referendum. The Western Sahara Group was formed initially at the initiative of the United States by officials who felt that the Friends of Haiti in particular was working well for the US. It was a moment of optimism in the early days of the Clinton administration about the optimism about the utility of the United Nations and the possibility of the United Nations and the US to work well together. And as one US ambassador who took a leading role in that effort described it, we formed the group to protect our interests. And I said, what were your interests? And he said, very understandably in the context, to improve our relations with Morocco, to maintain our excellent relations with Morocco, to improve our relations with Algeria, and to prevent any violence in the region. None of which had anything to do with the self-determination of the Sahrawi people or the UN settlement plan or anything else. As the other key members of the group were France, which is directly allied with Morocco on this issue, and Spain, which is kind of schizophrenic given its own past on Spain, kind of at a very difficult moment for Spain when Franco was dying, basically ceded its control of Western Sahara to Morocco and has a very complicated and sort of guilty conscious about the past, but an absolute need to maintain good relations with Morocco in the future, and therefore is very happy to hide behind the UN role, meant that the group, which has had an active role in sort of managing Security Council business, is actually very unhelpful in trying to
push forward any resolution, something that became very clear even when the UN at its highest moment of attention to this conflict had former Secretary of State James Baker toiling away in efforts to move it forward. The final case was a better example of something being useful. There was a core group on East Timor, which was effectively a friends group. It was only called a core group because the Australians were the week that the core group was formed thinking about forming a friends group, so it would have been a bit awkward for the UN to form a friends group under the nose of the Australians, even though that was one of its purposes, was to stop the Australians getting ahead of them. But the core group was East Timor, like Western Sahara would have been. It was the product of a kind of mangled decolonization, where the UN had, as in the case of Western Sahara, been looking at completing the process of decolonization since the mid-1960s, and then real politics kind of intervened, and just as Morocco in the mid-1970s marched into Western Sahara, Indonesia in late 75 annexed East Timor very violently, and there was a certain amount of wordage of protest from the UN, but no actual intention to do anything for a long time, because East Timor was very small and unimportant, and Indonesia under Suharto was very big and very important to the partner. So the UN did nothing for a long time, and then as the human rights abuses became more publicly known and the sort of a lot of pressure came up from NGOs and others and the Timorese themselves, the UN babysat it for a while. It oversaw tripartite discussions with Indonesia and East Timor without really thinking that anything was going to happen, because the Indonesia was solid on nothing happening, and it was solidly supported by key member states. It's interesting that during that period that the UN came under quite a lot of pressure from some of those member states to form a group of friends, and the UN officials working on it resisted it because they felt that if it was a group of friends, the friends would be all lined up behind Indonesia and would actually be counterproductive and make things worse. It was only when everything changed in Indonesia in the latter part of 98 and early 99, and suddenly with the collapse of the Suharto regime and the possibility of change and a rather surprising statement coming out of the president of Indonesia that if there was a referendum and the Timorese were not prepared to accept autonomy, then it should be let go, that a core group was formed. So the timing of the moment at which the core group was formed actually allowed it to be useful in a way that if it had been formed 2 or 3 years before, it wouldn't have been. Then there's one of the things that when I started work on the book, I sort of thought that those would be the cases that I would look at. And as I began to look further, I realized that it would actually be very, very short-sighted and limited to restrict myself to these kind of classic cases that could be addressed in full case studies because they fulfilled certain criteria with regard to friends of the Secretary General and the relationship to an established process and an established UN role. And meanwhile, as I was working and I began researching this in 2002, there were more and more other kinds of mechanisms that were kind of popping up all around me, and I would kind of groan as I would find yet more. In fact, there's a graph in the book which shows how they kind of grew from 4 mechanisms or so in the early 90s to more than 30. By the mid-2000s, and there's a horrible table beginning on page 285, which is a list of the mechanisms that interact with the UN. And I wouldn't have even been able to do that in any structured way without sort of support and encouragement from the people doing the Human Security Report, who I think were so pleased that somebody else was trying to pull together this list that they encouraged me to think that it made sense when I wasn't sure that it did. These other groups were not suitable for whole case studies, but that the Chapter 8 tries to look at how a more crowded field for conflict resolution forced the UN to create a new demand for the United Nations in terms of different relationships. It was no, you know, the number of cases where there was a UN mediator sitting neatly on top of a kind of pyramidal structure of supportive friends and the conflict parties and others has become very few and far between, and what you had was the UN left kind of in the lead of a number of cases which it had because nobody else wanted them.
Burma is a good example. There's a UN special envoy in Burma because nobody can think of anything else to do, and it's very difficult for any others to get in. It's very difficult for the UN to get in. There was an informal consultation group on Burma, which is it's Myanmar in the UN context, on Myanmar, which is absolutely divided by Western states with an agenda that's basically determined by issues of human rights and democracy, and regional states with an agenda that's basically determined by a lack of desire to rock the apple cart in Myanmar and very strong economic and other trading relationships that India, China, Thailand and others have. So the chapter looks at a variety of cases, some where the UN had the nominal lead, even if there wasn't a proper process, Myanmar, Afghanistan before 9/11, which was another case of a lot of states lining up and being very happy to support the UN role. It's always the kind of chorus at the UN is that we support the UN role. It almost inevitably means that it's going absolutely nowhere. Angola, where there was a friends group formed, but nothing really moved until the death of Savimbi. Cyprus, which is an interesting case because Alvaro de Soto, the mediator who had been the mediator back on El Salvador and has sort of observed and worked with these mechanisms as they grew up, has remained very consistent in his support of the utility of friends, but also increasingly jumpy about the risks and downsides of a formal group, of a formal group that can take on a life of its own. And as in the case of cases of some of the cases looked at in the core case studies, Georgia, for example, or Western Sahara, they can become, and Haiti on a number of occasions for the mediator, they can become very hard work, requiring almost as much mediation with and amongst the friends as amongst the conflict parties. They can turn against the mediator, they can undermine the mediator, they can give mixed messages to the parties. So that he felt in Cyprus, where when he took on the job there were a lot of other special envoys and senior figures working on it, that it would be too complicated to have a fixed group. But nevertheless, the Secretary General has referred to friends in the effort on Cyprus that ran between 2000 and 2004. Never actually named them, though everybody knew that the closest of the friends were the US and the UK, which worked very closely and supportively with the Secretary General. The chapter also looks at cases where the UN kind of didn't have the lead of a process but encouraged with mixed results the creation of groups. Colombia is one, and in distinct African contexts. Africa, there has been a very different approach to groups in Africa, where for several years there's been a sense that groups that mix powerful regional actors with interested Western donors offer a kind of optimum combination of local legitimacy and influence and knowledge of the conflicts with external resources. That's fine as a principle and as a general approach to African peace and security, but it has in a number of cases run into a lot of trouble for a number of reasons. So mixed levels of commitment from outside donors, and also mixed levels of intentions and capacities from regional states, particularly neighbouring states, and it becomes very difficult given the large number of African conflicts which are directly entwined in a hostile regional environment, and so that you can't actually talk about resolving the conflicts with neighbours because the neighbours are seen as the enemy rather than the friend. Classic case of this is the Horn of Africa, where there has been a series of efforts to have friends of, or committee of friends, or different groupings on Somalia, which the Somalis, quite understandably given what's happened in the last year, always kick and scream because they can't possibly see Ethiopia as a friend in that context. And finally, the chapter looks very briefly at the case of the Troika in southern Sudan, which was a friends-type mechanism which the UN wasn't directly engaged in because, for political reasons, the UN couldn't have an overt political role in the peacemaking process in Sudan, but from the outside the UN worked quite effectively with the Troika of the US, Norway and UK on the negotiations of the CPA in southern Sudan. And then he ended up with some conclusions and recommendations. I, very briefly, I will the
I, in the kind of conceptual framework of the book, I divide, in order to keep myself sane, I while struggling to look at what a friends group was, I came up with a broad description as an ad hoc, informal, issue-specific mini-coalitions of states or intergovernmental organizations that become involved in and provide support for resolving conflicts and implementing peace agreements. I distinguish between Friends of the Secretary General, generally small groups formed to support the peacemaking of the Secretary General or his representatives. They're distinct from standard diplomatic practice because they're actually recognized as a group, and they may be engaged throughout a peace process with different functions during peacemaking and implementation. One of the key findings is that you need to think very differently about peacemaking and implementation, where issues of coordination and function would be quite different. Friends of a country, somewhat a second section. Most of the cases that I look at in the book are in the first one. Friends of the country, more removed from the Secretary General and the operational process. They've been formed both on the initiative of the Secretariat and member states, and they tend to be more limited to kind of briefing and attempts to mobilize attention and resources on conflicts that nobody's very interested in. Angola at some moments, the Central African Republic, Guinea-Bissau. Guinea-Bissau is a classic case of a conflict which nobody has any interest in, which has about six different groups looking at it. Contact groups, which I don't look at. I dodge the issue of the contact group on the Balkans. It is a different kind of mechanism. They have much more distant relationship to the UN as vehicles for the direct diplomacy of key powerful state. Contact group on the Balkans runs diplomacy on the Balkans. The quartet on the Middle East is another mechanism which is distinct from a friends group. It's the US, the European Union, Russia, and the UN as a member, that is a forum which is quite controversial in its trajectory. And in fact, de Soto, who ended up his career as the UN special coordinator, ended up by deciding it was more of a friends of the US than anything else. But it's a forum for the coordination of diplomacy at the highest level, rather than a mechanism specifically supporting a peacemaking effort. And a fourth set are implementation and monitoring groups, which are increasingly common where agreements, particularly in African contexts, will create standing groups with a kind of mandate in the peace agreement to implement and follow up in the field on the terms of peace agreements. Beyond classification, the things that were difficult to made my work difficult, I found, was the extent to which friends are self-selecting mechanisms. They're formed as a result of the interests of the state. There are no disinterested peacemakers and there are no disinterested friends, and sometimes those interests line up with the goals of the peace process and sometimes they don't. They tend to be middle-level conflicts, in that for reasons I sort of implied earlier, the conflicts at the top of the international agenda, Iraq, the Middle East, the Balkans, won't be left to informal groups of states supporting the Secretary General. They'll have other structures. And they are, and for this reason, there aren't no kind of hard scientific criteria about when they occur and when they don't. And it's not all conflicts will have friends to the same extent, and it's very difficult to balance one against the other. And the final reason why it's difficult is peacemaking is very overdetermined. There are all sorts of reasons why peace processes work and why peace processes don't. And it's very hard to establish a causal relationship between the presence and performance of a group of friends and the outcome of a process. It's as easy to credit to successful friends exercise to good underlying conditions as it is to blame a failed effort on the intractability of the conflict as a whole. I will stop now. There's a lot I haven't said. And as Taylor, I took Chet's advice and didn't discuss the five criteria that I developed to look at what does and doesn't work, and nor did I run through because it's quite boring and it's in the book. I'd be happy to take questions on some of the conclusions and recommendations. But I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. I can't imagine that it's quite boring, but perhaps we'll have a chance to hear about it. Ambassador Crocker?
Yeah, I'm very pleased to have a chance to say a few words about this book, and to say, first of all, to underscore what Teresa said about it, as part of a continuing effort that we have made here at USIP to focus on mediation and to focus on mediation lessons learned, mediation tradecraft, and to focus specifically on the question of mediation that is often complex or multi-party mediation in the modern period. You don't really find many contemporary cases where one party, be it Jimmy Carter or James Baker or Marty Ahtisaari, gets it all by him or herself. So multi-party mediation we've given a lot of thought to here, and this latest publication, this latest volume in our series, is a really splendid contribution to what we have been doing here. It's a very, very powerful case of how to do a serious piece of research by drilling down, by knowing the players, by an exhaustive research process. How many footnotes did you say? 200, 100 pages, whatever it was. It's not the footnotes that are impressive. It's the diligence that is behind them that's impressive. You have mastered your cases, and so the book comes across as extremely authoritative in a number of respects. And I just would like to underscore that I think it's a great contribution. Teresa wisely says that the study of peacemaking is overdetermined, and that we're always trying to figure out, you know, what made the big difference. You know, was it in the case of San Egidio in Mozambique, and I see Andrea Bartoli in the back of the room, was it the food and Trastevere that made the difference in the Mozambican peace process? Was it the special skills of San Egidio? Was it the ripeness of the conflict? Was it the role of external actors working alongside San Egidio? Was it the skill of individuals working in San Egidio? What was it? You know, it's very interesting to speculate on that. And if you look at the six cases that Teresa's book drills down in great detail on, the three more successful and the three less successful, it would be interesting to ask you to what degree the friends account for the success and the failure in those six cases. But it's unfair, because you've already made the point that you can't isolate the role of friends or the role of external support groups as one independent variable. It's very hard to do that. I mean, it seems to me I will go right ahead and do it, though. it seems to me you can argue that one of the things that makes for real difficulty in some of the cases that have turned out to be hard is when you have a bad peace agreement. If the agreement itself or the peace plan itself is faulty, then you've got a problem. And you can have the greatest friends in the world, you can have the best Secretary General in the world, but it's going to be hard if you've got a faulty peace plan. I would argue that that's the root of the problem in the Western Sahara. But I think your point about how the friends have made it worse is very well taken. So what we've needed from the outset in the Western Sahara case is a different peace plan. And unfortunately, we're saddled with a lot of history in that case. This is both a scholarly and a practitioner account. So Teresa's book bridges theory and practice in a way that it makes it a logical fit for USIP, and another reason why it's a damn good read. I didn't find myself getting sleepy as I read it. I'm going to confine myself to a few comments on friends groups and support groups of that kind during the process of mediation, and not focus, even though I think it's extremely important, on what I would call implementing friends groups or the post-settlement friends groups, because that's Karen von Hippel's expertise, and I'm sure she will want to say something on that. And you do break it down rather nicely in your discussion, that there's really, you got to look at it in two different time periods. Implementation is really hard work, as we're learning in Sudan, as we're learning in Afghanistan and the DRC and lots of other places. But I think that breakdown of time is pretty significant. Friends groups are friends of what? Toward the end of your remarks, you picked out that key question, Teresa, which I think is awfully important. What are these self-appointed friends really friends of? Are they friends of an obscure place that needs friends? Are they friends of one side in the conflict, which in your analysis is so often the problem. And countries volunteer to join these friends groups precisely because they don't want there to be a peace settlement that would disadvantage or hurt the interests of their real friend. So in effect, they become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Are they friends of the United Nations? Are they friends of the UN Secretary General, which is maybe a slightly distinct point? Are they friends of a UN peace plan? Because in some cases, the peace plan that is being discussed or considered is in fact a UN peace agreement or a resolution that is passed the Security Council. So I think that distinction is pretty important. My way of looking at these groups in a nutshell is that if they add coherence, they're great. That's what they should do. They should broaden the base of the mediation and they should add coherence. And if they don't add coherence, they're probably a negative. But let me comment by illustration a little bit when I say broaden the base of a negotiation. When, during the 1980s, we began the process of trying to push for peace in Southern Africa in the Reagan administration, and I was learning about a lot of inherited diplomacy that was UN-based in Southern Africa, in Namibia specifically, I was coached and trained and learned a lot at the knee of a young man at the back of the room, Paul Hare, about the importance of something called the contact group. The contact group, which, as you referred to, Teresa, is slightly different from a friends group. This contact group consisted of the U.S., U.K., Germany, France, and Canada, who happened to be the Western countries in the Security Council at the time that a U.N. peace plan was adopted. But they didn't go away. And when the Reagan administration came into office, it decided that the contact group was indeed a very powerful mechanism. A mechanism for what? A mechanism for broadening our base as the lead mediator trying to get implementation of a UN plan. So we looked at the admixture of those other four allies as a critically important ingredient. Why? Great Britain historically had far closer ties and very intimate knowledge with Southern Africa and was, in a sense, our closest ally. The Germans could add a lot of heft because of their very important links to Namibia historically. The French could add a lot of heft because if they were against us doing nasty things from outside the tent, that wasn't as good as having them inside the tent. And so we decided that we needed the French on our team. They were permanent members of the council. They had a lot of African linkages and they could help broaden our base. It was like man-to-man coverage in basketball. If we want to go down the African field, we need the right flank and the left flank and the middle flank. We need all of them. The Canadians were there because they had been there from the outset, and they watched in awed fascination and admiration every time the French tucked their finger in the Americans' eyes. But they also added a little bit of breadth to the coalition. But it wasn't just a contact group. It was also, we had an African equivalent called the Frontline States Group, which we didn't create. It existed. It was a support group for the liberation groups in Southern Africa. And it consisted really of all of the neighbors of Angola and Namibia and Zimbabwe and so forth. So we were interacting, you know, within a context of two different groups, a Western group, an African group, on behalf of a UN, resolution. That particular group, I think, served its purpose for a few years. But when it came time to actually get to the short strokes, to get to the end game of negotiation, it more and more became necessary to broaden our base symbolically, which meant that every time we moved, we had UN people at our side helping us, advising us on the implementation phase, thinking through how large a UN contingent would be necessary and so forth to bring about the implementation of Namibia's independence. We also decided it would be good, stagecraft, if not tradecraft, to include the Soviets by inviting them to be observers, even though they didn't really come inside the room. But so you had an imagery of the U.S., the Soviets, at least having an observer in the same town we were meeting in, and the UN, as well as the direct parties. I'm not going to go into more detail in the interest of time on the way that negotiation worked out, but I would just draw the lesson from it, which I think is the same kind of conclusions that Teresa's book comes to, which is that coherence is important. The motivations of the parties that are friends are very important. If you have parties in your group, whatever you want to call your group, who have the wrong motives, get rid of them. Get a new group, or don't get any group at all. You're better off without them. What you really want, and I should perhaps mention that in addition to Paul Hare, I learned a lot from a guy named Marty Yatasari, who was one of the world's most skilled mediators and is now mediating, trying to do something with the Kosovo stalemate that we had. And he's doing it with, I guess you could call him, two friends, Frank Wisner and Wolfgang Ischinger, an American and a German, trying to bring this thing to a head. Why? How did this happen? It happened because the Secretary General asked Marty Yatasari to try and fix Kosovo, which is about the most impossible assignment you could imagine. And Yatasari who was a brilliant mediator, said, I need help. I want some help. I want visible help, and I want symbolic help, and I want real help, professionally skilled people. And so he asked for the two other people that he's got working with him. So I guess the bottom line for me is watch out, control your group, get a group that's there for the right reasons, and maybe you can add to whatever your own capabilities are. And that point applies to the Secretary General as well. If the Secretary General is himself or herself the mediator, then he or she has one heck of a job trying to figure out how to limit all those people who'd like to volunteer, because everybody wants, if it's the SG, everybody wants to be in the photograph. And in fact, let me just share one other anecdote and turn it over to Karen. We used to keep Perez de Cuellar, a former Secretary General, very, very closely informed during the 8.5 years I was in the State Department of what we were doing in Southern Africa. He had everybody on his contact list. There wasn't any relevant party that had an interest in the Angola-Namibia equation or the Southern African equation. There wasn't anybody who didn't have access to the SG. He met with them regularly. He met with the Soviets. He met with us. He met with our contact group allies. He met with the frontline states and their leaders. He met with the liberation groups. He also met with non-governmental organizations. He got expertise from wherever he could find it. So he became himself a kind of clearinghouse of information, and a couple of people on his staff really knew the brief, at least as well as we did, and we thought we knew it pretty well. So it's a great book.
Thank you very much for those comments, Chet. Next we turn to Karen von Hippel.
All right, thank you, and thanks to the USRP for inviting me in. Teresa, for writing a really great book, and Ambassador Crocker also for your comments. It was really interesting reading this book, because I was struck by my own experiences dealing with some of these informal friends groups, and Teresa really encapsulated it in a very excellent analytical way. What I wanted to do today was briefly mention two of the groups that I've been involved in an informal way also, working for the UN as well, and then talk a bit about why we recommended such a mechanism a couple years ago for Sudan. I was working for the United Nations as well as Teresa in the late 90s for the Department of Political Affairs in Somalia, and then I went to Kosovo to work for DPKO, peacekeeping operations. And I guess, if we go by Ambassador Crocker's way of, and Teresa's way of disaggregating them, the Somalia experience was more on the mediation side, whereas the Kosovo was more on the implementation side. But if I could just sort of reflect a little bit about those experiences, I think that they reinforce the conclusions in Teresa's book, which is a nice thing about a good analysis, is that you can actually slot extra experiences in. These aren't the cases that Teresa chose, but she did mention them in the book. In Somalia, of course, there have been a million and one different phases back in the days when Ambassador Crocker was involved, as well as throughout the 90s when there was a lot less interest. I started working in Somalia in the mid-90s, but I was working for the UN in 98 and 99, and at the time, similar to Sudan, there was an IGAD Partners Forum liaison group and a standing committee on Somalia. So we at the UN were part of this liaison group, informal friends, however you want to define it, on Somalia. We, you know, we debated a bit about whether it was a standing group or a liaison group or a standing committee. But essentially, it was not a huge success. We met in Addis every 3 or 4 months throughout 98 and 99 when I was there. And of course, it started before I arrived, obviously, and continued after I left. But really, in my view, some of the problems that we experienced were five in this particular case, and they were all reinforced by Teresa's conclusions. The first was really that we had a lack within the group of forceful leadership. So the IGAD Partners Forum liaison group, of course, it had the European Union, the United Nations, it had Norway, Italy, you know, the major friends, plus Egypt, and I can't remember, at some point, Yemen may or may not have joined us, but they were the interested groups. But within our group itself, while the UN should have been the forceful leader, we were really unable to do so because we had no support at headquarters. And so there wasn't a clarity and purpose, as Teresa mentioned. The second problem was that there were competing visions for a future Somali state. Now, you have Ethiopia on the one hand wanting a very decentralized state next door, so it won't get into a conflict, and Egypt on the other hand wanting a very centralized, unified state, similar to what they were pushing for in Sudan. So you have competing interests of two countries that are essentially fighting over the Nile, but using Somalia as a proxy war, and really interfering in a number of ways. And we had a couple times we had to stay up all night drafting a document, and then at 4 in the morning, Egypt would come back and say, "We disagree with the draft," basically just trying to block us whenever they could. Of course, we also had a third thing was there was war, of course, between two of the member states at the time, Ethiopia and Eritrea. Fourth was there were continued conflicts in other IGAD states, Uganda and Sudan, and Sudan was still hadn't signed the peace process at that time. And then finally, there was a lack of interest by the major powers, by the United States and by the UN headquarters, in making peace happen in Somalia. You know, there was not a lot of interest. And so therefore, we were basically left on our own. We'd go to these meetings, we'd write our cables, and we'd send the information back, but very little happened, and there was very little interest at headquarters in what we were doing. The second experience that I had in Kosovo was a little bit more positive. Kosovo, I think, as everyone here knows, there was the QUINT, which was the informal mechanism that was set up to really deal with Russia. So it was the four European countries, Italy, Germany, United Kingdom, and France, plus the United States. And then there was also the contact group, which was the formal group with Russia that I didn't really get involved with very much. But the QUINT played a very important role from the very beginning of the UN mission in 2000 when Kushner, well, even earlier when Sergio de Mello was there, but I arrived in 2000, all the way through to the Martti Ahtisaari process. And so they played a very important role in helping the mission as well as in the status talks. The four European countries, of course, were the major donors to the mission, but also the major providers of troops to the NATO mission. And so, of course, they had a direct interest in seeing that things worked out. Now, they also provided a lot of guidance to the special representative, the Secretary General, Bernard Kouchner, but also his successors. He could go to them as a group rather than going individually to the states to talk about the concerns of the mission at the time. And as I mentioned, they did play a very important role in dealing with Russia, because Russia basically was trying to delay throughout that period. And this really became more critical, the role of the QUINT, when the status talks started. What was interesting about the QUINT is that it's an informal group, so you won't really find any documents about it. You'll find a lot about the contact group, but there's very little about the QUINT. Even though they have met at ministerial level, you won't be able to follow up. You'd have to do what Teresa did in this book, which is just interview a whole bunch of people that were involved to find out the role. So, you know, in that sense, that they played a very important role on an informal level. Now, because of those experiences, the experiences that I myself witnessed, and of course I was in Haiti in the mid-90s, in the early days when it actually was going fairly well, there was a good friends group back then that met on a weekly basis. You know, I saw the positive aspects of that, and of course, when we came out with a report in early 2005 on Sudan, and we recommended some sort of contact group on Sudan. Now, of course, no one followed our recommendation, but it was just the way we recommended. I mean, we recommended a contact group for three reasons. One is We felt that India and China needed to be part of it. Now, the contact group that was set up later in the year doesn't have India and China on board. And, you know, the importance of a contact group is also so that everyone speaks with one voice and so that spoilers don't play the different parties off of each other. We also felt that it would help apply concerted pressure to end the fighting, and then when you get to the implementing of the peace agreement, which has been very difficult to negotiate for Sudan, and of course very difficult at a number of stages along the way. And then of course a problem that you have in all conflicts is how do you prioritize what should happen and sequence what should happen in these countries emerging from conflict. And typically different groups will have their own priorities, and so in order to get the major powers and the major donors to agree, we felt that that was another key thing to do for Sudan. When I was there in early 2005 and interviewing even, you know, the groups that should have similar priorities, the Brits, Americans, etc., the European Union, you'd find that they had different views on Sudan. And so, and at that time, there wasn't any body bringing everything together. There were a whole bunch of different coordinating groups, a whole bunch of different donor trust fund groups, etc., but very few where the special representative, the Secretary General, would sit in on those meetings and direct and really give his guidance. And so we recommended that he set that up. Now, finally, just before I finish, I think there are two important things about this book that I really appreciate. It's important, and Teresa talks about this, the informality of these groups is very important, that they can come and go. Now, the positive aspect of that, of course, is that you know, they can surge and not surge. They can play a very quiet behind-the-scenes role, like Professor Bartoli's group has done in Africa. But of course, when you document this type of activity, there's always a risk of publicizing it too much or bureaucratizing it too much. And I think that's something that, you know, Teresa has been dealing with, because people come to her now and say, should we set up a friends group or not? And you don't want to have this formula that, you know, will likely not be successful. The other important aspect, of course, is the size and how to keep them small, because, of course, if it becomes a really important political group, everybody wants to play. And if everybody wants to play, it no longer has the importance that it does when it's a smaller, more coherent group with really the most important players for political, financial, or other reasons. Now, I guess I just want to finish by asking Teresa really a question about, I guess, you know, what I thought was quite fascinating was thinking about the role of the quartet right now in the Middle East. And you just mentioned that in your concluding statements. I think in some respects, to me it seems like, even though it is a high-powered body, and yes, it is a friend of America potentially more than anything else, to me in some respects, it seems to me like it could be more effective, because I think the U.S. government is, you know, the cost of failure for one mediating powerful country is very high. And so a friends group or the quartet itself could help to spread the risk of responsibility in managing a group like this, and potentially could have more of an impact because it's not just one group that will be blamed if things go wrong. And so it would be quite interesting, maybe in terms of future research or to follow up on something like that. But anyway, thank you again, and thank you for writing a really great book.
Thank you, Karen, and thank you to all of you for your excellent comments. We're going to open the floor now to questions. Please identify yourself. And since we don't have a mic set up for questions, raise your voice so that everybody can hear you. Yes.
Yesterday, officially, Smith universities are speaking more as a professor rather than as a senior representative. We have Edward Bauer, who actually is from Santiago, living here, so we have different votes. Just a brief comment, if I can, before the question. And the comment is just a thank you for the great book, because I think that says something new, and it's wonderful to read something new. But also because of the problem it poses theoretically, and how you move from practice to theory, how you move from reality to theory, how do you theorize? Because I think that Chet and Pamela and Ken have done a great job in creating the framework for this to happen, and I think it must happen more, because what happens is that we see patterns, but the patterns are exactly as you describe them, amorphous. We are not sure. We don't know exactly what a group is, and we do not know what friends is, and what the group of what, and so there is an uncertainty, and yet there is a certainty that something like this exists, and that it makes sense to systematize the knowledge, to verify the results, to create mechanisms for evaluation, and also to offer the mediator of case, you know, to the Alvaro of the case, you know, not just the gut feeling of the politician that goes one way or the other, but actually hard data of saying, well, in this case it worked out, in this other didn't work out, and these are the problems that you have. So you can drive your car in a much more secure environment because you have a sense of this. So the question is really more to your own theorizing process. I can definitely hear, you know, very, very strong realist arguments behind. I can see very strong liberal arguments behind. I can see constructive arguments behind. So I'm curious on how you locate the book and what is the trajectory that you see on these more theoretical points. That is to say, how you see the book proceeding in helping not just the practicality of saying, well, how are we going to do the next group of friends, but rather, how are we going to understand these problems that are curiously intriguing? No one ever before wrote a book like this, but not clear so much that we know exactly how to do it. So there is a methodological problem here.
Let's take each question in turn.
Okay, all I can say is that I struggled with the methodological problem, partly because in comparison with, I suspect, everyone in this room, I feel very uneducated. In being a Brit, I hardly spent any time at all at university. Because if you go through the British system, you whiz through a three-year first degree, which was at Cambridge, which is in the plus column, but in the minus column it was in English literature, and then I did a one-year MA, and that was it. So I always have to keep quite quiet about it. But it led me to struggle with methodological problems. I mean, what I ended up with was looking and trying to anchor the cases, both the core cases and the more varied cases, in these five points, which are the regional environment, the conflict. The regional environment is obvious, as practitioners of conflict resolution know. You don't get a solution without a regional environment which is propitious to a solution. I just don't think you do. Not a lasting one, anyone. Conflict parties and the level of interaction with the third party peacemakers. This was a really interesting one, because it's not just that the friends groups vary with the extent to which they have prior knowledge and contact with the conflict parties under the umbrella of the overall mediation, but one of the very critical findings I found, it was one of those things which of course came to me far too late in the day, like a light bulb going on, you feel like an idiot, you didn't notice it at the beginning, was the extent to which the utilities of the more operationally inclined friends was varied very greatly depending on the diplomatic capacities and behaviour of the opposition, insurgent, secessionists, whatever you want to call them, the non-governmental actors, the non-governmental armed actors, the insurgents, the secessionists. In several cases, critical to the utility of the friends in El Salvador and in Guatemala, and I would argue different in East Timor, because it was a conflict thing, but again the Timorese, or in southern Sudan, was the sophistication of the diplomacy pursued by, you know, whether it's the FMLN or John Garang. You have conflict parties who have been conscious of the potential utility to them of the international community. They may want to manipulate it, it's the most normal thing in the world, but they want to engage with it. In the case of El Salvador, which had a political diplomatic office in Mexico throughout the conflict, and the diplomatic representatives of El Salvador were actually of a higher quality by some way than the diplomatic representatives of the government during much of the war, and it really impacted on the negotiations and it impacted on the friends. So, and equally, the engagement, and you contrast, you know, what the Troika, which was partly formed to get away from SIGAD mechanisms to avoid the structures you described, was able to do, was very greatly benefited, that the leverage that it gained very greatly benefited from the nature of the conflict party. That was the second one. The leadership, issue of leadership and how that works. Timing within a peace process. I seem to have written down five core variables, and I know there were five, and I've ended up with four. No, I've completely blanked. I will remember.
in a minute what it was. But I do think theoretically it's difficult. I mean, I'm so grateful to USIP for working on this area and for giving a home to the book, because I do think it's difficult to place theoretically because of the grey areas of the grey areas in terms of there aren't clear analytical lines, and the grey areas that relate that come from but cannot cut through the differences of each cases. And obviously you're doing comparative work. Yeah, composition is the other one. The size and mix of composition, where you see that, as Karen pointed out, small is so often better but harder to achieve. But it is very difficult to have a kind of theoretical and analytical rigour through something that is necessarily such a messy grey area. On just picking up before we go to other questions, on Karen's point about composition, one of the things that's worked quite well in several cases is when there are lots of states pressing to be involved, is having a two-tier structure and a bigger group that meets every now and then for briefing and is kept involved and is made to feel that they're on the inside and they know what's going on, and then the smaller core group or informal real friends who needn't necessarily be identified as such, who are the actual people you can do business with. The classic case of the problem that Chet cited in terms of the Secretary General forming a group, in most cases, even when they're friends of the Secretary General, the key officials are the Secretary General's representatives for a given conflict, and they will carry the mediation, and they use the Secretary General as a tool of last resort, either in a positive way to come and pinch the deal or in a negative way if things are really going badly. But in most cases, the Secretary General is a little bit remote from ongoing mediation processes. There was a formation of a group of friends of Angola late in the day, much later than the Troika, which Ambassador Hare was so involved in. Which became an awful muddle, because it was the Secretary General's idea to form a group of friends, Kofi Annan's, and everybody knew it was, and then suddenly, and he'd, ironically, he wanted to form a group because he felt that nobody was paying attention to Angola, and that this was terrible because what was going on in Angola was the humanitarian situation was a disaster, and it was all ghastly. But because he wanted to form a friends group, suddenly 22 states appeared out of the woodwork, clamouring to be friends of Angola. And so it was a total zoo, and then you had meetings of 22 states and Secretary General's agendas very full, so you had 22 states meeting for 30 minutes with the Secretary General, and it was a mess and had to be was cut down. So the question of composition epitomizes the tension between legitimacy and efficacy, which underlies a lot of what the UN does, where you want to be legitimate and include everybody, but if you include everybody, and Peacebuilding Commission is the latest incarnation of this, you include everybody, then it becomes really difficult to get anything done.
Other questions? Go ahead, Chet.
I just wanted to pick up on Andrea's question, take it in a slightly different direction for a minute, and then I had a question myself for Teresa. It seems to me that if you were to take the chart on page whatever it is, 285, of the trajectory of friends groups, it would track. You could probably do a correlation with the trajectory of peace processes or of conflicts.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the fashions, the international political fashions of a particular era. I mean, look back to the early 90s, everybody wanted to do peacekeeping, and everybody wanted to be involved in some fashion or another. This is a remarkable graph. It's just it's sort of got that shape to it. It's kind of like this subprime mortgage market, only it's in the other direction. Okay, everybody wanted to do peacekeeping. So we sent forces in during an operation called UNISOM into Somalia, as you recall. And we were trying to rally a coalition of the willing. The French got there before the U.S. Marines. That's how bad they wanted to be in the photograph. So, you know, CNN's up there with it. And the French are coming ashore on a U.S.-led operation. It was fabulous. Go fast forward to the late 90s, and it's this. Everybody wants to be in a peace process. Now we have a global war on terrorism. Everybody wants to be part of the global war on terrorism or to join the Proliferation Security Initiative. I guess what I'm saying, Andrea, I think some of this is kind of constructivist. What world do you want to be part of? What kind of activities do you want to be part of? My question for Teresa is a simple one. What do you think of elders groups or comité des sages, as they're called in parts of Africa these days, groups of former leaders, not current governments, but not states, and not NGOs, but Jimmy Carters and the like. What is your take on that? Do they have any role to play? They are also self-appointed, looking for relevance. What is your thought on those types of actors?
There is this new elders group, which you will know much more about than I do. With
like an elder?
Yes. I'm trying to remember whether you're a member of it. No, with Mandela and Kofi Annan and Jimmy Carter and people. I think I'm slightly wary of the kind of one-size-fits-all elders group, and I just don't know how engaged they will be, a very crowded and messy environment like Sudan at the moment, where you have an awful lot of people flying in and out very briefly. I think it may be if they're able to be, and a lot depends, the question of leadership. I mean, a lot of the efficacy of a friends group and the efficacy of these very messy international processes will depend on the personal standing that the mediator has, not just with the parties, but whether other mechanisms and individual states or individual actors or NGOs consider them worth supporting. And they, I imagine, can be extremely helpful if they're articulated with an ongoing effort that's a real effort and has a good solid basis, and could potentially be disruptive if they're flown in, because you can bet an awful lot of money that, you know, the parties in Darfur will divide and rule when they possibly can, and that if there is a chink, then they'll go for it. And if they see, no, I'm not just talking about the parties in Darfur, but parties of conflict, if they see getting off the plane, you know, six elderly, venerable former heads of state, and they offer a promise of advancing in ways that the existing peacemaking structure, then it could be quite complicated, I think. But one thing I do think on the implementation thing, which Karen raised, which I meant to go back to, I've got two quick points on the points you made, that the implementation, I actually think that if I was an SRSG, I can think of few circumstances where having a coordinating body wouldn't make sense. Even if they disagree on stuff, those are the states you're dealing with, and you want them in the same room. Even if, and as is most likely, you will have other conversations with your closer partners outside. But I would, very different from peacemaking, where I would by no means, I think in most cases in this day and age, it's become too complicated to have a group because of all the issues. But for implementation, I can really see few circumstances where a group, particularly you have a peace agreement which is everybody signed up for. If you're the SRSG, you're the result of the mandate of the Security Council, so you at least nominally are there as an expression of the support of the international community. So you might as well create a structure that, even if again it's only nominally, but bolsters you as a representation of the will of the international community, even if there are all sorts of other things going on underneath. That's one point. And I do think that one of the things that I found emerged, it isn't really the central subject of this, but I found it's one of the most striking things that emerged from my research and all the interviews I did with all sorts of different types, and is that the challenge to the future, and this goes back to Andrea's question, of competition amongst the do-gooders.
Yeah.
I mean, situations, Sudan, where you have, you know, Netherlands at loggerhead with Norway, or Norway not unable to speak, but Norway and Sweden tussling over Somalia. And these are the good guys. This is before you get to China and India and you know, Yemen and Ethiopia and Egypt. It's a very, very touchy subject. There's these sessions of very high-level mediators, or fairly high-level. They have a kind of B team, which people like me sometimes go along to, but these mediators workshops in the Norwegian government backs, and very interesting discussions, very frank, extremely broad range of people representing multilateral organizations and states and NGOs and all kinds of mediators from all over the world. The one subject that people dance round the edges of because it's too sensitive.
Yes, here on the side.
The book is unashamedly, it's sort of a book about diplomacy and conflict resolution, and therefore is looking at those. I don't at all discount and the enormous importance of what you're talking about. One of the factors when I began writing the book was I really wanted to do a book that drew heavily on original research, which I really enjoy. I live in New York, have two small children, so can't travel for long periods of time, and I know lots of senior mediators, so this offered an opportunity to do lots of first-hand research without doing what in other circumstances I would probably be doing, which is lots of field research from the bottom end up. I don't know of such mechanisms. There was a tent, Mr. Udabdala, who's just been appointed to be the special envoy on Somalia, that last week had and has been a fellow of USIP, I think, at one point wrote a book for USIP. When he was in Burundi, he had an NGO group of friends, which he worked quite closely with, but he's quite funny about it. He said it went wrong because he found that the NGO's interests were different from state interests, but they had their own interests, which depended on their survival and funding and things. So when things started getting a little bit better, they kept on giving interviews. The NGO, the message coming out from the NGOs, according to him, was that things were getting much, much worse because they were still trying to attract attention and resources to their brooms that went on. That's there aren't, in from the lens that I'm looking at, I haven't come across things from the bottom up, but I probably wouldn't have seen them because I visited a lot of the countries that I did case studies for, but in very flying visits, and I talked to the conflict parties, but inevitably I was talking to the conflict elites as well, I mean, rather than the different kind of research altogether.
Karen wants to add a comment.
Yeah, just a comment, because I think you raised an interesting point. I mean, at the top end, you have the problem of important countries that aren't included in these mechanisms. For example, in Kosovo, Japan and Canada were, you know, the two in the top five in terms of funding of the mission, but they were not invited to join the Quint. Everyone assumed Canada agrees with everything America says. So, you know, they would get a bit upset about it, understandably. So, you know, what does that do to these countries' interest in sustainability and staying involved in these types of things when you want them to stay involved? And then at the bottom end, what you're talking about, I remember when I was in Sierra Leone, and there were all these NGO bodies that were set up to liaise, et cetera. And I met with a group of civil society, I hate that term, but a group of civil society leaders from a whole bunch of different NGOs that were basically excluded. So it was those who were disabled but not disabled because of the war, and, you know, those who weren't part of these community mechanisms that were set up. And, you know, you can go at a number of different levels of really trying to make sure that people feel included and they're participating and that they're also enjoying whatever it is that everybody else is enjoying, you know, the money coming from the mission or the political process or things like that. So it is a very difficult aspect.
Go ahead.
And I want to thank you for the book. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but you certainly whetted my appetite. I'm looking forward to learning a lot. I guess my question goes to a comment you made about the competition among users and the relationship between international and local. And I'm wondering if you look at friends in terms of the relationship they might have or have thought with locals beyond the implementation stage, these two different stages?
I think it has enormous impact, and one of the things I should have said probably up the front is one of the interesting things about Friends is their capacity to exist in different places at once, so that you can have a Friends group in New York with a different manifestation of the same Friends group in Guatemala or Tbilisi, and then sometimes in the Georgia case you have the Friends also existing in Moscow. And actually, curiously, they can be all quite different, even when they're supposed to be the same. But in the best cases, they're sharing information, and it's a very efficient way of ensuring a unified message. One of the things it does is highlight the utility of having really good people on the ground, that the country-based people have, in certain cases, made an enormous difference. And again, going back to my point about the conflict parties and the relationships, in some cases, whether it's the ambassador, the diplomats who are based in the field, or it may be somebody who's in New York but has a history of knowledge of a particular conflict, in many cases, personal relationships. If you look at the difference between the Troika in Sudan and what happened in Darfur, the Troika was peopled by, as one of them told me, kind of Sudan addicts. They would compete as to how many decades they'd spent in and around Sudan. And in some cases, in the case of Norway and the UK in particular, the lead people had known people on both sides of the conflict, the North-South conflict, for 20, 30 years. So you're coming with vast resources of knowledge and credibility with individuals. Or you have there's a couple of very good, I think, of a Spanish diplomat I know who was in Guatemala, who had contacts with everybody across the political spectrum, and they're really doing the job, will see as part of what they're doing the fact that they're talking to the army and NGOs and others. So you can actually, when it's working well, it's a good mechanism for feeding in that knowledge and credibility of proper knowledge into a process. I will also say that, I find the case of Guatemala particularly interesting and particularly sad in that respect, where you had good, credible UN mediation, good Friends group, very committed to the case, and I worked on it a bit from the mediation, a bit from New York, agreement which was criticised by being too broad and not specific enough, but not a bad agreement, and missed the mark so badly in, as we now see, in terms of what's happening in Guatemala. Not that the peace process, not that the agreements 10 years ago bear responsibility for what's happening in the country now. It's very arrogant on the part of the international community to blame everything on a peace process such a long time ago. But there was a real sense, and I think it comes out in the chapter, of you have to look at these things with a real sense of humility in terms of how the things like it wasn't realised at the time how poorly representative, even of the government they represented, was the government negotiating team. So you've got a sort of conspiracy for peace amongst a bunch of very good, very committed people, including the government representatives, who were able to get through agreement on an agenda and on a set of agreements which the actual political centre of the country was not with. So that you... And that was in a case where there was very good knowledge, there was, on one hand, very good knowledge of Guatemala and very committed and very good set of conditions and commitment, but also highlighted how humble we have to be from outside about actually understanding the internal dynamics of countries in conflict with long and violent histories, and that actually you can work on a country for 10 years and just come out feeling that you don't understand it at all. That was one of the, despite all the book being about kind of international involvement and third parties and the value of learning from lessons and trying to do as good a job as you can, I also came out of it feeling, in spite of this huge acceleration of involvement, that we should all be a lot more humble. Some of the very best people I know at the UN or elsewhere working on this field are amongst the most humble about this.
Teresa, I'd like to ask a question that you may not be able to answer because this is the first time that you've presented the book, but I know you've talked to people all along the way, mm-hmm. including the 200 interviews that you did. The question is about the receptivity to learning and improving on this mechanism of multilateral diplomacy. There is a bit of attention. Professor Bartoli talked about systematizing what we know. And then Karen mentioned, but we don't really want just a template or a formula that's blindly applied. So somewhere in between that there is this question of, you know, is diplomacy an art or a science? And where is the proper balance? So there are two learning mechanisms. One is individuals involved in these processes can pass on their knowledge, which you've mentioned. And so first question is, to what extent have the people you've talked to been interested in this project beyond just telling you their stories, but wanting to, you know what other people say and look for commonalities? And secondly, there's another learning mechanism, which is much more institutionalized. Are there organizations that have best practices units or learning centers or anything like that that are taking this this on and trying to impart lessons learned within their organizations?
Interesting side of it. I think to the first, hugely varied, that some of those who are friends who, I mean, people I've interviewed but I've also worked with or known for a long time, there's a real range within the kind of people who end up, particularly at the UN, but probably outside as well, but particularly at the UN, there's a real range in the kind of people who end up as mediators. And as I'm sure USIP is probably uniquely well placed to observe, that some of the more thoughtful will come through USIP or be supported by UN. You know a lot of them here. And some of them are, their main reaction has been amazement that there's so much of this going on, or they've struggled through their own process, and then they hear about somebody else's horrors, they were all pouring when Alvaro's Alvaro's end of assignment report to the Secretary General, which was confidential, was suddenly published on the Guardian's website. All the other UN SRSGs I know were pouring over it in kind of I got several emails from a couple saying, God, I thought I had it bad in X. and so there is. And they feel kind of cheered up a bit that others have struggled. Others are not at all reflective and are not very interested. I find myself in some circumstances where you're actually interviewing an SRSG who hasn't thought about this in any way at all, and he might be in the middle of a group and something happens that a group is established and then people change, and then SRSG goes to a country and he's just told that once a week you meet with this group and once a week you'll go meet with the group and and even if he sees it as a useful mechanism for coordinating and briefing, isn't really thinking about it. So that varies enormously. During the sort of time I've known the UN and even the process of researching the book, I think the culture of thinking about lessons learned has changed a great deal. And the culture of turning outside, the program I run at the Social Science Research Council is called the Conflict Prevention and Peace Forum, and it was set up initially with Akhtar Brahimi as the first chair and came out of his work on the Brahimi Report in 2000, and its function is to bridge between the UN and outside sources of expertise on conflicts, be it people who have been working on the inner dynamics of the Kivus for 20 years or other practitioners, and that was set up in 2000 and it would have been unthinkable in 95 and were very heavily in demand. But again, there's a self-selecting group of people and missions who turn to us. There's been a huge effort in increasing the capacity of the DPKO's best practices section and some of the work they do. Sometimes it's interesting at the moment with DPKO going through this massive expansion, there's a sort of back current of concern on the part of some, and I don't share this, but it's a real question, and I can see it, that you, by codifying best practice and being the UN, it tends to kind of go into an overkill, so you get a very kind of codified and documented best practice stuff, and in many respects you can go, if you visit a peacekeeping operation, you can be a bit shocked by how many people are you could have put them in Long Island City because they seem to be stuck in headquarters kind of in the headquarters of the peacekeeping operation, servicing New York in some ways to fulfill things. And there, you know, you can go places and be quite surprised by the small proportion of the peacekeeping operations political stuff that's actually kind of out in the country because of some of the demands of the greater institutionalization of best practices and practice. So it can be, it's on the whole a very good thing, but I'm not sure the balance is quite right. There's been far less attention at the UN until the recent effort that started with the high-level panels led to the creation of an absolutely tiny mediation support unit. There has been, and it's something under Kofi Annan. Kofi Annan wasn't very interested in peacemaking. He wasn't interested in this stuff at all. I didn't get to interview him. I interviewed a lot of people around him, and I've heard him speak on peacemaking, and he's really quite dull. Duller than I should think anybody in this room would be on peacemaking. I don't want to be quoted on that.
You will be.
Yeah. I mean, he's fascinating.
Great guy, otherwise.
Yeah. No, I admit, but he's fascinating and huge amount of you know the work he did at times of crisis on the telephone and a huge amount of direct intervention on his part, you know, on a constant basis. The sort of bread and butter of the day of the Secretary General is needing to talk to one president about another president and hooking things together and that kind of front line. Diplomatic peacemaking or conflict prevention he did the whole time, and at times of crisis he did it extreme. You know, the case in this book that comes out most immediately on that is East Timor, and the Timor crisis he played absolutely critical role, but it just isn't his thing to be particularly interested in the practice or art of peacemaking as you were describing it, and people are different, and it that sort of some of the lack of attention to conflict prevention and peacemaking within the Secretariat in a period which peacekeeping went up reflects on that, I think. But it's supposed to be shifting, and time will tell whether it does. But it is possible changing.
Thank you. I know Ambassador Crocker has to leave a little bit early. Does anybody have a final comment or question? No? Okay. Well, in that case, please join me in thanking the panel for an interesting conversation.